Welcome to ASME TechCast, bringing you the innovators, the innovations, and the issues that push the envelope of engineering. This is Jeffrey Winters, Editor-in-Chief of Mechanical Engineering Magazine, and I'm talking about indoor air quality with Jennifer Ventrella, mechanical engineer who's a graduate research assistant at the Tishman Environment and Design Center at the New School, and as well as Barnard College. Those are both in New York City. Ms. Ventrella, welcome to the big show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So for those out in podcast land who probably realize this, air quality is an important and underrated issue. Here in the eastern United States, we were confronted with it this summer due to the clouds of wildfire smoke that blanketed the skies. But there's a less obvious and more pernicious source of air quality hazard, the common kitchen. Ms. Ventrella has led research into indoor air quality in kitchens and how it affects the environment in households throughout, especially in New York City. And she's here to talk about her findings. So let's get started. So to set the stage, so indoor air quality has been identified as a health challenge in many places in the developing world, where cooking is done over open hearths or braziers or other smoke-producing appliances. But I think people would be surprised to learn that cooking can also create indoor air problems in places like the United States and Europe. And can you walk us through this topic and sort of, you know, set the parameters for this?
Certainly. And yeah, just to preface, I led research during my master's degree in more developing contexts. So Uganda, Honduras, and also worked in Burkina Faso, and then worked as a graduate research assistant with We Act for Environmental Justice, who led this study in New York City. So have really seen, you know, how cooking can really be a problem in kitchens in any part of the world. So even though we see that attention to indoor air quality has tended to focus on biomass fuels like charcoal and wood, or non-solid fuels like liquefied petroleum gas, which are fuels that are often used for cooking in areas that aren't really yet widely electrified or don't have built out gas pipeline infrastructure. We see that cooking with natural gas, which is more common in these more widely electrified and networked areas like the US and Europe, also contributes to poor indoor air quality and negative health impacts. So while we find that it's important to maintain that focus on indoor air quality in these more non-electrified or built out areas, it's also really important to look at pollution from cooking with natural gas in places like the US and Europe. So we see that as of around 2020, around 38% of US households still cook with gas appliances and gas stoves in particular, and around 30% of households in the EU. And we find that in particular, places with really old housing stock in the US and Europe tend to use gas stoves. So New York State has an especially high prevalence of cooking over gas. And then another reason that we see is that there was this big push starting in the early 1900s of this narrative that was fueled by propaganda from the gas industry that led us to believe that cooking with gas was superior to cooking with electric. So you saw that kind of narrative that's really, you know, remained prevalent in US culture today. And then finally, I think in any region around the world, equity and justice are really a central component of energy transitions, of which, you know, transitioning from gas to electric stoves is part of. So we see that in really any place in the world, low and moderate income households are often left behind in this transition, even though they're contributing the least to global emissions. So even within countries that have relatively less widespread access to electricity or gas pipeline infrastructure, there are still really vast disparities in the access of cleaner cooking fuels and technologies, and urban areas often have more access. And so we see that these same types of disparities are true of the United States, where low and moderate income households often have a really hard time accessing cleaner energy sources, technologies, and even programs to subsidize these types of initiatives. And then they also face higher concentrations of pollution in their environment. So we find that prioritizing equity within the energy transitions is really important, regardless of the geographic context. And that communities all over the world, like I mentioned, face health impacts from cooking pollution.
Yeah, I mean, it's from my own experience going camping and having to, you know, thinking about a developing world context, I lived in Ghana. For those who don't know, I lived in Ghana for 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer, and so there was a lot of cooking over open fires. And you think, you know, well, that's the way it is. But you know, you think of, but then you come back to the United States, and you're camping, and there's an open fire, and the smoke comes in, and I know from experience of from that. You can, it just, you feel kind of lousy after, you know, breathing in smoke for just a day. And that's sort of the baseline for health impacts if you're cooking from over an open fire, open hearth all the time, right? I mean, people probably don't even realize how impacted they are because it just becomes normal.
Completely.
Yeah. Yeah. So to sort of drill down on the issue in the United States, you worked with We Act, which is a housing advocacy group. Is that right?
An environmental justice. Yes.
Environmental justice group. And they conduct, you and We Act conducted research into the indoor air quality in New York City public housing. So, you know, why was that community selected? Based on the age of the housing stock, I bet I know. But also, and how did you conduct this research?
Yeah, so I think first and foremost, we know that environmental justice communities, which are low-income communities and communities of color that are already overburdened by these compounding effects of air pollution, rising energy costs, poor housing conditions, and climate change, are also disproportionately impacted by the negative health outcomes associated with gas stoves. So these communities are also often the first to be left behind in the transition. So we wanted to take an explicit focus on these communities within the US to better understand the landscape of gas to electric transitions in this context. So our pilot involved 20 apartments that were in an affordable multifamily housing unit in the Bronx in New York City. Okay. And that area in particular has a really high prevalence of asthma as well. And so the study that we conducted, it's called Out of Gas and with Justice, and it was led by We Act for Environmental Justice, and specifically Annie Carfora, who's at We Act. And then it was done in partnership with Berkeley Air Monitoring Group, Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health, Rocky Mountain Institute, and the New York City Housing Authority, and then AEA. And I worked as a research assistant supporting the study. So the study involved, like I mentioned, 20 apartments in a single public housing building in the city. And so we had 10 apartments where we switched out participants' gas stoves for a new induction stove. And then the other 10 apartments kept their gas stove and served as the control group over the entirety of the monitoring period. And then they ended up receiving induction stoves at the end of the study. So over the 10-month monitoring period, we performed both regular air monitoring of various pollutants, and then we also performed controlled cooking tests. And so the controlled cooking test is a method that helps us to isolate the emissions from cooking on the stove itself compared to external sources like the gas boiler or cars outside. So it's very standardized. And then we chose the building itself for a couple of reasons. First, we conducted this pilot in a New York City Housing Authority building in the Bronx, which is an environmental justice community, which, like I mentioned, has some of the worst air quality in the city and leads to disparities in health outcomes. And then NYCHA, or the New York City Housing Authority, is also, and they have been working on trying to achieve deep carbon reductions by transitioning their building stock from fossil fuels to electric powered appliances. And so because they're trying to be this model for multifamily decarbonization projects, we felt like the building was a really good fit from that context as well. And also definitely older.
older too. So you did the study. You had 20 using gas, 20 that you switched out, or 10, or excuse me, 10, 10 with the gas, 10 with that you switched out for the induction.
Exactly.
So drum roll, what did you guys find? I mean, was there what sort of difference did cooking with gas make versus cooking, you know, via electricity?
Yeah, so we had two really major findings that were related to our measurements of nitrogen dioxide. So first, we found that over that 10-month monitoring period, households that had induction stoves had a 35% reduction in daily nitrogen dioxide concentrations compared to those that were using the gas stoves. And that's after controlling for temperature and apartment level factors. And then the second major finding that we had was that during the controlled cooking test that we did, we registered levels of nitrogen dioxide that exceeded even outdoor air pollution standards. And we found that on average, the nitrogen dioxide concentrations in the apartments with gas stoves were 190% higher than in those with electric induction stoves. Wow. So pretty disparate.
Yeah. And what about, you know, like volatile organic compounds? I mean, I know that that's something that, that people are worried about in terms of combustion, where things don't get combusted quite right. Was there a difference with that, you know, natural gas versus induction, or was some of that just like overwhelmed by the volatiles coming off of food?
Right. So, yeah. So we know that all forms of cooking release some level of pollutants from the food itself being cooked, mm-hmm. like you mentioned. So that's over any type of stove. And that I think is particularly fine particulate matter or PM2.5. Okay. But then we know that gas stoves also emit nitrogen dioxide, which we know that electric induction does not. And nitrogen dioxide is linked to different respiratory conditions like asthma. We also know that from the controlled cooking tests that we did, which show that even when we cook the standardized meal on a gas and an induction stove, and we control for things like mm-hmm. food quantity, the recipe, the cooking conditions, nitrogen dioxide emissions, like I mentioned, are significantly higher.
Gas stove. Okay. So I have a gas stove. Well, I mean, I check off a lot of boxes. I have a gas stove in my apartment here in Brooklyn. It's an older building. We leave the windows open a lot, but it's still, you know, I'm sure that we're getting a lot of pollution from our gas stove. So this hits home. So based on your research, what are your recommendations for people like me and for people who have gas cooktops, you know, anywhere?
Yeah, definitely. So we have some guidance that we shared with the tenants that were participants in our study that we share more widely as well. And so if you don't have the ability to switch over to induction, make sure to keep your windows open while you're cooking. Any additional ventilation is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And then if you have a range hood to have that on and at pretty high power. Mm-hmm. And then one thing that we know for especially low and moderate income households is that they often don't have adequate heating in their buildings. And so we'll sometimes try to use the gas stove for heat in the winter. So we definitely advise against that for any households. But, you know, overall, the best thing that you can do to protect your health and the health of your family is to try to switch out that gas stove for electric.
But that's, you know, just to pull on that for a second, that's not always easy, because especially in an apartment building, because a lot of it's based on how much electricity is coming into the building. I know that I was talking to our building manager last month, and he said there was only, I think, 600 amps coming into our 84 unit building. And so there's not really enough electricity coming in for everybody to switch over to an induction. Is that a problem for a lot of housing stock?
Yeah, I think especially with older housing stock, and that's something that we faced in our study, was that we actually had to upgrade the electrical capacity of the building to be able to put those stoves in. So it's definitely something where we act as advocating for taking like a whole of building mm-hmm. approach. It really needs to be a comprehensive approach.
So we're doing this research with WEACT, which is an environmental justice group. What's WEACT's priorities right now, or do you have any sort of legislative priorities that you guys want to hit home or get across the finish line, or whatever the proper metaphor is?
Yeah, completely. I think there's one major one that, you know, kind of grew from this study, or, you know, we saw while we were doing the study was an issue, which is that current government programs aren't really designed to address the existing conditions that New York's most vulnerable populations live in, because overall New York State has, like I mentioned, a really old housing stock and a chronic issue of deferred maintenance. So WEACT has been working for decades in communities that have faced these really disparate and widespread housing issues, things like mold, lead, asbestos, and pests. And buildings have to take care of these concerns first, just to be able to reach the starting line for electrification. So oftentimes, low-income residents that are living in buildings with conditions like these aren't even able to access those electrification benefits because they need to clear out things like mold, asbestos first. And there's no government program right now that helps buildings to address those health and safety concerns first. And so instead, they're simply disqualified from participating in other energy efficiency programs. So WEAC this year is advocating to pass what's called the Energy Efficiency, Equity, and Jobs Act in Albany. And the bill would allow state energy efficiency funding to go towards health and safety issues. So that way, buildings with low-income tenants are given the support that they need to electrify. So WEAC has been working hard in the past year to try to get that over the, as you mentioned, finish line. So. Yeah.
Well, that's good. One other thing, just sort of on this point, because I think you mentioned early on that there was there's sort of like this big controversy earlier in 2023 about gas stoves and sort of the politicization of it, and it seemed that gas was this luxury that, you know, oh, look at me with my you know, $1,000 Viking cooktop, and I don't want to give that up. But it seems like the impacts of gas cooking are really hitting the folks who are not at that level, who are this is their cook stove, and they don't have an option of what to cook with.
That's completely right. And, you know, these are the same households that also might not have range hoods or ventilation. Like, right. Every participant in our study didn't have a range hood. So they have, much less option to transition or to mitigate those pollution impacts.
Is there like a single take home message, you know, that you would like everyone out in podcast land to know about this? I mean, is it just to switch out natural gas? What is it that you want people to know about this topic?
Yeah, I think maybe a couple of key points and key takeaways is that first, for healthier communities, we need to create both a cleaner electric grid and transition to cleaner appliances across the board. So we really can't take a piecemeal approach. It should be comprehensive. So we see those benefits from the energy source itself and then also where it's being emitted in people's homes or outdoors. And so, you know, if we have electric stoves in apartments that are near gas power plants and gas powered transportation, we won't see the same magnitude of health and environmental benefits. So we really need that comprehensive approach. I'd say second, like I mentioned earlier, we need to prioritize equity and justice in clean energy transition so that everyone can participate in the benefits, especially those that are currently disproportionately impacted. And then I think finally, because, you know, this is Mechanical Engineering Magazine, right. We really need more engineers and skilled workers and technicians in the clean energy sector to enact the scale of the transition that's required to support everything from technology development and testing to installation and long-term maintenance. You know, we have a lot of the solutions now, but we really need to figure out how to enact this type of scale of transition. So engineers and other skilled technicians will play a really critical role in the shift from clean energy to clean energy and electrification.
Right. I mean, just to pull on that last point, if you don't mind, you are a no, it's podcast. No one, but you're a young person. Your classmates in mechanical engineering and the your colleagues who are around the same age, do you see that they're really interested in this topic and not just clean energy, but sort of like the social equity issues in underlying it? Is that something that's motivating folks your age?
Yeah, I definitely see that. I think there's a lot of excitement around those kind of intertwined issues. And I do also see people of all ages really starting to get involved. I think, you know, we've had longtime environmental justice leaders and advocates that have been fighting for these issues for decades. Mm-hmm. And it's really started to become, you know, more of a widespread movement that a lot of people are catching on to. So I think it really excites young people. And then you all also start to see, you know, academics, policymakers of all ages start to really, you know, latch on to that concept because it is exciting and I think it is really important.
Well, we have to leave it here today. Jennifer Ventrella, thank you. Thank you for joining us. This was a really great talk.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
And for all of you out in podcast land, thank you for listening and be sure to subscribe to ASME TechCast on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, or whatever other podcast platform you prefer. Until next time, this is Jeffrey Winters. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks.